Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, today we begin our discussion of Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen. I know there's a lot of you out there have been waiting for this moment. So what we've done is we have brought together, I think, a very special panel of ladies who are all Jane Austen Pride and Prejudice aficionados. So they're waiting to get after this. So let me tell you who I have in the studio with me today. Of course, I have my wife, Deborah, is here. She is a former English instructor at Imperial Academy. She teaches home economics at our college. I also have Sarah Evans, who is a science instructor at Imperial Academy, and she does all kinds of things like biology and physical science and everything. So she's really, really great at all that. And also I have with me Elizabeth Clark, who is a two-year graduate of Herbert W. Armstrong College. And she is on Skype with us from Stratford-upon-Avon, England. Of course, that is the home of William Shakespeare, and I always have to mention that as my second favorite place in the world. So welcome, ladies.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So it's good to have you here. So I'd like to open today with a quote from William Darzowitz. And William is an author. He is a literary critic. He's a contributor for The Nation. He's also a editor and contributor for The American Scholar and The New Republic. So he is really, quite a man about town in that sense. He writes for several magazines. He's also a former professor at Yale. And so he openly admitted that he resisted the 19th century British novels, but especially Jane Austen. And so I have to admit that I'll make a confession here that I had felt the same way until some of the ladies here on campus have kept asking me, well, when are we going to do Jane Austen on the radio? So I finally had to get with it. But I have to admit I've fallen asleep almost every time my family, and that's my wife and four daughters, would watch a Jane Austen movie. I fell asleep during every movie. I've had her books on my bookcase for decades. Knew I should read them. I never did. And I got into a book by Darzowitz, and he also was a literature major, but went on to graduate school, which I did not. But he went on to graduate school, and he was forced to read 6 of Jane Austen's novels in one summer. And so he actually had a change of heart. And so I would have to say I also have a change of heart. But I want to open with a quote of his from a different book that he wrote, and it's called Jane Austen's Education. I do recommend the book. We won't be reading it necessarily on the radio, but it really is it's kind of a critique of all 6 of the novels that she has produced. And so, but he says what he's learned from the novels. So here's this quote, and I think it's a good way to open up. But he writes, "Growing up may be the most remarkable thing that anybody ever does. We come into the world as a tiny bundle of impulse and ignorance. How do we ever become fit for human company, let alone capable of love? This I discovered that summer," and he's talking about the summer that he had to read the 6 Jane Austen novels. He says, "This I discovered that summer was what Jane Austen's novels were all about. Her heroines were 16 or 19 or 20. They started out as girls, and day by day, page by page, before our very eyes, they turned into women. Excuse me, it was the way they did it, though, that came as such a revelation to me." And I think we have to understand, we kind of look at Jane Austen sometimes from a 21st century perspective. And, but we can actually look back and realize maybe she was really onto something. Maybe she really saw something that we have failed to see or don't see as well today. So he goes on to say, "I was used to thinking about how growing up in terms of going to school and getting a job and passing tests and gaining admissions and accumulating credentials. But Austin, as it turned out, did not see things that way. For her, growing up has nothing to do with knowledge or skills because it has everything to do with character and conduct. Now, I thought that was a great quote, and it kind of slapped me in the face. So again, that's taken from his book, Jane Austen, Education. And so I really believe now that I would share that same sentiment with Darrowswitz. This book really has everything to do with growing up, but I believe it means growing up right. And so ladies, let's get what your take is on this timeless book. And Elizabeth, since you're so far away across the pond, let's let you go first. So tell us, what do you think about this novel? And, you know, we know you really love it, so you don't have to say that, but we can just we'll just ask you to tell us what you think of the novel.
I absolutely agree with the quote you read, and that it is absolutely about character. It's considered one of the greatest romance novels of all time, but there is a lot more to it than that, because the plotline is essentially about overcoming character flaws. Both Darcy and Elizabeth, they're realistic individuals. They have their faults brought to their attention, and they strive to overcome them. The title is fantastic, Pride and Prejudice, because there's so much depth behind it. It's obviously Mr. Darcy's main flaw is his pride, and Lizzie's is her prejudice. But there's more to it than that. Lizzie is prejudiced against Mr. Darcy after he makes an appalling first impression. But her prejudice stems from wounded pride because he insulted her. And then on the other side, much of Darcy's arrogant behavior stems from his prejudice because he doesn't know her or anyone else there. He just assumes the company is beneath him, and so he insults everyone. So they're both proud and they're both prejudiced, and they're completely blind to it for the first half of the novel. And then you get to the middle of the novel in chapter 34, and he proposes and she says no. And the subsequent fallout brings their faults pretty forcefully to their attention.
So the thing I think, if we look at it, and just remind everybody out there that's listening in, there are three separate books in the novel. So you have section one, then you have section two, and you have section three. And so what I think is interesting, Elizabeth, is... you know, I think all of us out there, I mean, we've heard about Jane Austen, we've heard about Pride and Prejudice. I know my daughters will always say, Dad, you know, you need to read this, you need to get into this, you know. And so we've all heard about Darcy, we've all heard about Elizabeth, we've all heard about Jane. And I think you can form your own opinion of them, of what's really going on. And I have to admit, I thought the whole thing was just a romance novel. And so I'm sure there are people out there listening who are going, it is a romance novel. But when you really look at it and you really read it, especially once you get through book one and you get into book two, that's when you begin to see, well, things get revealed and you do see this change. And of course, we are going to have this men's panel after we're done taping these ladies' panels. So unfortunately, the ladies don't get any rebuttal, but we're going to examine some of these. I think the comments she has about male development, I think it's there as well. So go ahead, Elizabeth. Sorry.
I think it's absolutely right what you said about there is a change in the novel when it goes from being about some indefinable things and it's just all these people meeting and Jane likes Bingley and Bingley likes Jane. And suddenly it does change, like you said. I think that the turning point is the proposal. It's probably my favourite scene in the novel because Austen does a fantastic job, because the scene is written from Lizzie's point of view. So she gives all of Lizzie's perspective, but her descriptions of Darcy's reactions are good enough that you can see what Darcy's thinking at the same time. So Darcy gives all the reasons why marrying Lizzie is a terrible idea, even as he's proposing. So, of course, she says no, and she absolutely lays into him and goes through every detail of just how horrible he's been. And he's furious and he's hurt, but you can tell that what she's saying is sinking in. And he does accept that correction and he does change. And when you see him later in the novel, he's a lot more considerate and he's a lot kinder to others. He's not blatantly rude. And then Lizzie does something similar, because after the proposal, he sends her a letter and she finds out that so many of the accusations she flung in his face were actually based on lies. And instead of digging her heels in, she realizes that she was just believing the worst of him because he'd insulted her. She realizes that was unfair and that was wrong. And so she receives a rude awakening as well. And she's a lot more careful from then on to judge by actions rather than appearances. So at that turning point in the proposal, you see the characters start to change. Yes, that does eventually lead to the romance and the happy ending and the sappiness. But that couldn't have happened if they didn't change. The focus is on how they grow and change so that they can have the romance, not on the romance itself.
Yes, what I think is really interesting, Elizabeth, is, you know, I think it, when you, by the time you, like I said, it is a little hard to get into, because you do, you're introduced to all these things and you're introduced to, you know, all the characters, and you have Mrs. Bennett, and you have Mr. Bennett, and then you have the Lucases, and then you have, you know, then you have like the sisters introduced, you know, Darcy's sister and all that. So you really have to work hard to keep straight. But I think the one thing that you see, you're talking about like first impressions, but I think one thing that comes through really clearly in the book is that Elizabeth has been shaped by her environment. You know, she's not the upper aristocracy, but her opinions have been shaped. But so have Darcy's. I mean, it's like he is, you know, very wealthy, and there's all this talk about, you know, when the women all get around and they see Darcy, he's got a lot of things going for him. One, he's dashingly handsome. Second, he's got money and wealth, and they always say, well, he's like a 10,000 or maybe 15,000. And, you know, so they all look at him, but then he appears to be a snob. And in some ways, his environment or his wealth has put him in that position where he is. His first impressions are filtered through that whole scenario. And so I do think it does. Darrowswitz is really onto something when he says, you know, they start out at 16 and 19 and 20, and then we see them develop into women. Well, we see Darcy develop too. He has to recognize that his environment has actually misshapen his perception. So I think that's really, there's definitely a lot more going on than the romance. And if you don't get these other things right, really the lesson is the romance isn't going to come. So now go ahead. Sorry, I just had to interrupt you.
I think you're absolutely right about how you see at the beginning of the novel how their environments have shaped them. It's like Darcy's in a situation where he's living in a society where your breeding, your money, your power, that all matters so much. And he's been thrown into society which behaves very differently to what he's used to, and so he assumes everyone is beneath him. And it's easy to dislike the character for that, and he does deserve condemnation for that, but at the same time, he doesn't know any better. It's almost as well as learning not to be snobbish, he's also learning more about the world at the same time. And Lizzie, too, is being exposed to a completely different kind of environment that she hasn't been in as the novel goes on.
Yeah, so I think it's really, really fascinating. We'll talk about this a little bit more. But I do think it's fascinating that here you have Austen, and she is teaching. I mean, it's not just a novel. She's teaching. And she's teaching about society at that time. And so we really can't get a view of England. I think that, you know, like this is like an upfront, like a 60 minutes close up. And she's put it all in the context of a novel. So, okay, well, thanks, Elizabeth. Let's move on a little bit. I wanted to get Sarah involved here. I know she has some unique understandings of this book. So, Sarah, what's your take on the book? So,
Well, I think one of the things you brought up was about how the book can start a little slowly. It can take people a little bit of time to connect with the characters. And I think whenever we see a character-driven novel as opposed to a plot-driven, just like in a real relationship, it takes you a little bit of time to get to know people, to really form that bond where you are feeling connected and really with them and with their storyline. And I love the tool that, you know, I think to the extent that Jane Austen uses a frequent mechanism to kind of move the plot along. And one thing you see through all of her novels is the ball. You see the dance. And it almost seems as though Regency time, women simply passed days and months at a time with their needlepoint and their letter writing while waiting for a dance. And that is essentially the one opportunity that they had to meet eligible men, to be introduced into a greater circle, and hopefully to marry, because that was ultimately, you know, what their life was aiming toward. That was the fulfillment of their role, in a sense. And so the fact that Jane Austen herself loved dancing, loved balls, her characters all love dancing and love balls. One of the things we hear about Mr. Bingley first, before anybody's ever met him, is that there's a quote on page 5 in chapter 3 about Mr. Bingley and the report of him before any of the girls have met him. And they say, to be fond of dancing was a certain step towards falling in love. And they were talking about Bingley because they all knew he would be interested in a dance or having a ball. So it really was a way to meet people. The gentleman couldn't ask a woman to dance unless he'd been introduced. But at a ball, there's lots of parents around, chaperones, friends of friends. So a gentleman could ask to be introduced to a lady and then invite her to dance. And unlike dances today that might last 3-4 minutes, where you have that one song to interact with someone, dances of the period would have been 20 or 30 minutes. And then a dance would have been, there would have been two dances in one set. So a man could meet a woman, take her out on the dance floor and spend an hour in her company right then and there. And the dance would have been very active, very aerobic, more calisthenic, more energetic, very exciting and fun footwork. Not the movie versions where it's very slow and sedate. But because it's an hour long, you're not dancing and kicking up your heels the entire hour. You have pairs of couples that would go down the line, do their footwork, and then stand for a little bit while the other couples did their footwork. And so then you had time to talk. And of course, we see that in the Netherfield Ball when we do have Lizzie and Mr. Darcy finally having... They've had conversations before, but this is where we kind of see them sort of teasing and bantering a little. Yeah, and it's another field ball in that situation.
I think it's kind of, I think it's very interesting. I mean, I can look back at my own, let's say, my own teen years, and the big thing, and I mean, now we're going back to like late 50s, early 60s, but the big thing was the street dance.
Mm.
There were no parents there. You know, they would have these big playground programs where, you know, they'd have, it was kind of like summer education, but we'd have a coach and a teach, we called them, and then, oh, we'd do art and things like that, and then the big end of the season was this street dance. It was like tribal, you know, it's just nobody's, there's no refinement, there's just loud music, maybe some bright lights, but then, you know, you're in your tennis shoes and you're on cement and, you know, things like that. But one thing I think that really impressed me about the book was how the families were involved. And again, I was really impressed that dancing is really a big part of the book. It mm-hmm. was really a big part of courting.
Mm-hmm.
It was really a big part of dating. But what you don't have today is you don't have the parents as involved. You know, you don't get these formal introductions anymore. And it's almost like I can even remember back into my teenage years that, well, we didn't discuss those things with our parents. We didn't tell, well, we kind of like this person or that person. Or, you know, there's even one part of the book where I forget who it is. It's not Mr. Lucas, but it's like, I think it's Sir William. Mm-hmm. And he talks about the importance of males knowing how to dance.
Mm-hmm.
And he says it's part of polished society. Well, where is that today? We don't have that. Let's say in your certainly upper middle classes and middle classes today. And it's really, I think it's really an essential part of, well, raising families.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she brings it out really great in the book. And it is really impressive. We're here at Herbert W. Armstrong College. We're trying to get that back. We're trying to recapture those values where, you know, the, like when we have a grad ball or the graduation ball, you know, the faculty's all there. We're there with the students. You know, we're watching the students, observing the students. And of course, we're encouraging dating. We want, you know, our young students to, you know, meet someone and marry. And it just so much of that is just, well, marriage isn't even emphasized anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Well, where's the need for marriage today? Yeah, I mean, that's really sad.
The quote that you had mentioned at the beginning about Jane Austen being such a beautiful example in her novels of character and conduct, I think, as you were mentioning, that sense of decorum and family involvement in the courtship, that's really an aspect of the ballroom, particularly in that period, because you really do see this beautiful combination of propriety and passion. And so you have an opportunity for there to be uplifting interaction between men and women with certainly appropriate degrees of physical contact and opportunities for banter and really kind of livening something that's very youthful. A lot of the older characters in the book always sit along the sidelines. They just enjoy watching, but they're there part of the whole picture. And the man really stepping into his role and leading and inviting a woman to dance and even asking for an introduction so that he may dance with a woman, really stepping into his masculine role so the woman can fulfill hers and demonstrating that degree of fulfillment of the roles. And as you mentioned today, I mean, it's really sad to me that in my ballroom classes, the instructors always joke about the fact that ballroom dancing is the last place where a man still leads and a woman still follows. And sadly, it is the last place, and it shouldn't be. And in the Regency period, it wasn't the only place, but it was the first opportunity to really see how someone would respond to those roles. So when Mr. Darcy refuses to dance at the beginning, you're really seeing something about how unattractive that was in him. He was refusing to serve these women, and he was refusing to help out in a situation where his masculine role required that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Maybe I'll say this about Sarah. Sarah's done a lot of ballroom dancing, has actually won, you know, contests and things like that. So, and she's not talking about Dancing with the Stars, by the way. And so that's really a 21st century degeneration of ballroom dancing. So if any of you are out there offended, maybe you need to read Jane Austen's book to really get the true picture. But the thing is, if I could just interject this, what really also impressed me is the desire for good conversation. I mean, I know you mentioned about the ladies doing, their needlepoint and, you know, doing their writing and doing their artwork and things like that. But they did have a focus on education and being intelligent women. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like they were just kind of like hidden and kept, you know, from being educated. They wanted to have good conversation, and I thought it was really, it's kind of laudable, is that there's that whole scene with I think it's the second time we see Darcy, Mr. Darcy, with Miss Bennet, I'll say. And, you know, she noticed she was carrying the conversation, and she stops thinking, well, he needs to pick it up and, mm-hmm. and lead this conversation. So I think that's really great. Mm-hmm. And then he takes the cue. Mm-hmm. He picks it up. But there, of course, she's jabbing him the whole time. Mm-hmm. And he knows she's jabbing him. And so again, that's really quite funny. So, Deborah, you want to just, I know you want to say something here. So I'll let you interrupt Sarah for a minute here.
Well, yes, that is... It is interesting that there's so much that happens at the ball and that was just shocking rudeness that Mr. Darcy wouldn't dance and everyone was aware of it there. You know, that was what they always talked about, and they knew that Mrs. Bennet, from Mrs. Bennet on down, they just thought he was a rude, you know, person that because of the way he acted at the ball. So that was an area where they all got to kind of know each other in the community as well. So that was very interesting.
The other thing I think I want to add to that is, and I'm talking both to Sarah and to Elizabeth over there, is it just what seems unique to me is you can get the idea that the upper aristocracy were completely separate, and then that the middle class, but here at the balls, they interconnect. And so in some ways, what Mrs. Bennet was doing, I could look at her as a dit sometimes, but really, for a woman at that time, if I'm understanding it correctly, the big success in her life would be to marry up, not marry down. And am I getting that right? Do you both agree with that? Yeah.
Well, I think just to speak to the aspect of the ball and how that played in there, you're absolutely right. There's different kinds of balls. And so the first dance that we see, that assembly ball, was an opportunity for anybody who wanted to just pay to attend. So there would have been tradesmen. And of course, we see Mr. Darcy, a landed gentry, whereas opposed to like the private balls at Netherfield might have been more just those in your social, your particular social circle. But yes, I'm sure Elizabeth can address more, you know, speak to more to the point of how exactly that was, that interaction.
Yeah, it's absolutely right that marrying up was definitely considered a good thing. But it's easy to look at the social classes and think, oh, there's very defined social classes, got upper, middle, lower, and they never cross over the lines. But actually, it's really more of a spectrum. So Darcy is actually, on oddly enough, not the highest of upper class. He's actually sort of somewhere in the middle of upper class because he doesn't have a title. And Lizzie, because her father is a gentleman who owns land, she's kind of on the lower end of upper class rather than being middle class. So she could theoretically marry down to a tradesman, but she could also marry up into the landed gentry. She's in a position where her social circle is actually unusually large.
That's something I think Americans have trouble understanding. Because in America, I mean, basically you can start an absolute pauper and become one of the wealthiest men. I mean, that was the goal with the founding fathers that they started. And so they really wanted to get away from this stratification in society. But I think Americans are fascinated with it. I mean, you look at Downton Abbey, that was probably one of the most popular programs, you know, in America at the time. I didn't necessarily agree with everything. I didn't like how they did, they sewed some of the, let's say the immoral things, you know, but I'm sure that probably happened. But I think Americans are fascinated with English society. And I think some English are fascinated with American society because it is so different that way. Well, ladies, I just have to say we're running out of time. And I knew this would happen, but we're going to continue this next week. So we're going to have the ladies panel back next week. So again, sorry we're running out of time, but I would very much like to hear what you have to say about our new summer series. Now, again, next time we're going to have the ladies panel only, and we'll be discussing Jane Austen's, obviously, Pride and Prejudice. And then after that week, then we're going to start on the men's panel. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter @JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. And there are a lot of you doing that, liking the page. I really appreciate that. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.